Hey everyone, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs comes to you live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern, and you can catch us on twitch.tv/wanderingdms or youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about our favorite D&D adventures that we would love to run over and over and over again. From classic tournament modules to sprawling campaign epics, we're going to think about what makes for an adventure that stands the test of time. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into today's conversation, I'll remind everyone that, as always, at the end of the show, we'll be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat that we host on our Discord server, and you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, pledge at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. Get your account set up over there through the course of the show, and maybe 10 or 15 minutes after the end of the show, we will be on there live.
We love that part of our week every week. And, you know, Paul, I'll point out that this topic that we're talking about today, our forever favorite adventures, was something that actually came up in one of those after chats kind of organically between us and our viewers about why are there adventures that we like and why not. And I think I you know, in the chat, I must have said there's a couple adventures that I wouldn't mind being on a desert island with one adventure and just run it over and over and over again with hypothetically good players. And so the question came up about what would those be for us and different people. And, you know, you viewers, if you're in the chat right now, we would love to hear from you what your favorite adventures are and maybe things that we don't know about. I tend to be a little bit of a TSR zombie, a little bit, based on my traditions. So sometimes I need other people to tell me about other adventures that are great that I haven't heard about.
Dan, I maintain a spreadsheet for conventions of what adventures I've run as convention games at various conventions and what year I ran them, mostly to just try to avoid accidentally repeating the same adventure too close at the same convention, because I assume probably going to see a lot of the same people, and I've already done that. I don't want to repeat myself. But it was an interesting artifact to go back to and look at, so I could talk about kind of, well, there are clearly some adventures in here that I've run at, I think I have a total of 6 different conventions listed here in my spreadsheet. And there are a few that I've run at every single one. That's, you know, a nice little piece of data there.
Nice. That's super. I respect that. Yeah. We respect the spreadsheet foo.
It was nice to have just a historic record of stuff like and sort of, you know, be honest with myself about what adventures are so good that I seem to keep running them over and over and over again.
That's great.
My list, you know, has very little TSR in it, so it will be interesting to compare our lists.
Great. That's great. I will say, so, you know, I did get in the hobby, frankly, right at the same time that adventure modules started getting published. I didn't initially have, when I was a kid, I didn't initially get original D&D. I got the Holmes Basic set initially, like many of us, and that was right pretty much in the same year that the publisher of D&D started publishing adventure modules for the first time. And they went several years where they philosophically resisted that as a bad idea, frankly. So probably for the first 4 or 5 years, they didn't want to do that. And they were publishing supplements and rules, and they started, you know, they published dungeon geomorphs and monster treasure assortments of like tools for the DM to make their own thing. And it wasn't until 1978 that they started publishing the first adventures for D&D. And initially, they were all tournament modules. They were things that were being used at the Origins convention or the Gen Con convention for the big AD&D tournaments, the big D&D tournaments at the time. And the weird thing is that the first batch of things they published were all super mega high level. Specifically, like the last week or so, when you and I, Paul, have been talking about like what levels do we expect to make our dungeon design dashes, or what levels do we have characters for? There are the first batch of half dozen adventures in 1978 were all at a higher level than you, Paul, would ever want to run. I know. So
that's hilarious.
Yeah. So it's a funny, you know, there was a point where the creators had been running D&D or things like D&D for all, you know, the better part of a decade. They were already kind of jaded in some ways. Their current play style was very high level. And this was the kind of product and the kind of adventures that they were producing. And they weren't market savvy enough to think about, we need to provide an on-ramp for new players to start adventuring. And so it's a very weird selection. Right out of the gate, you had the hardest, toughest, highest level modules. And then they thought about other stuff.
Interesting. I wonder if you can't map that against like the eventual release of the basic set, right? Like I feel like the basic sets are probably what launched them into massive, you know, mainstream success, and clearly are targeted at introducing new people into the hobby. And it almost was developed sort of, I don't want to say against their will, but like, not by design, right? It was brought to them by an external force.
Exactly. I think it's a very interesting case and a very interesting point that you can see in some of the editorials by Gygax at the time in Dragon magazine, that what he's working on, we're talking 78, 79, is his magnum opus of advanced Dungeons and Dragons, with the first ever hardcover books and a completionist take on, clearly this is the master product that's going to make D&D a big thing. And then J. Eric Holmes comes and says, you know, you want to do something to make it a little bit easier for new players, maybe a basic set. And I think that to Gygax's mind, that was kind of like garbage time. And he was like, yeah, sure, maybe that'll be some kind of income stream. And you can see him about a year later, very irritated that the basic set was wildly outselling advanced D&D. And he was surprised by it, and he didn't expect it, and he was kind of irritated about it. And as far as the adventures go, one of the things that happened was the initial adventure for the basic set was written by Mike Carr with In Search of the Unknown. And as a result of that being in the basic set, that was by far the most widely distributed adventure at the time. And Gygax was a little bit, well, that's not right. Why isn't my name in there? And he wrote the famous Keep on the Borderlands specifically to replace the thing in the basic set, because that was getting published more than anything else.
Funny. And I'm sure that both of those, B1 and B2, are probably on a lot of folks' lists of just so, at least so nostalgic, right? That I feel like I see those two modules run quite a lot, especially B2, especially Keep on the Borderlands.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting to think about is like, is there some advantage to having these common experiences? Because when I got into D&D, there were only six modules. There were only six, seven, maybe eight adventures in the world. And everybody that was buying D&D in stores, and, you know, we all had this common experience of going through these adventures, starting with Keep on the Borderlands, frankly. You know, as the market becomes bigger and the experiences become wider, you don't have that wide a commonality of experience. And sometimes I wonder if that's a pro or a con in some ways.
Interesting. All right, shall we get into our personal picks?
Yes, please.
Why don't you kick us off?
Okay, my favorite adventure series is the Against the Giant series. And that was basically the first series that they published in 1978. Again, for very high level characters, like levels 8 to 12 or something like that. And I want to see the covers of that, Paul. So well, if you get a chance there, if you could pull up the three G-series Giants covers. You know, and at the time, you didn't even have multicolor printing, right? So all these adventures in 78, 79 were monocolor covers. And, you know, the first couple of, they're only like 8 pages. They're very curt. They're very tight. And I've run this series multiple times in a couple of different venues. You know, I think I get better at it all the time. And so here's a pitch for why I really love the Giant series. Arguably, Advanced D&D was written to support this series. Like, there are times when I look at what is Advanced D&D, and people will say, well, it's to support tournaments and it's to standardize stuff. And you could almost argue that AD&D was specifically written to support this series. And the rule set and these adventures work really nicely hand in hand as support stuff. You have the Ranger class, which is specialized for huge damage output against giants specifically. There's a whole lot of, you know, this is at the level that practically all the examples are in AD&D. So you go through the spell list in AD&D and it's like, oh, for example, 12th level wizard is almost always the example of like magic being cast. And that's the level that you're going to be playing at here. So there's a lot of kind of like expectations that this is sort of the kind of par thing you're going to be doing in Advanced D&D. Some people talk about Gygaxian naturalism. I think that this is the height of Gygaxian naturalism. It's you get these very well-defined communities of intelligent creatures. They all have, you know, gives Gygax an opportunity to think about where do they sleep? Where are their barracks? What are their kitchens like? What are their larders like? What are their basements like? What are their pets like? And you have a lot of opportunities for this very tight, cohesive community to be built out kind of as a whole thing. It's not a random bunch of random monster in room, random room, random room. It's like a really tight community and very cohesive, which is kind of interesting. I'm always a big thing on playtesting. These all came out of really big tournament gaming sessions. So they've been playtested pretty heavily. That doesn't mean everything is perfect, but I like the fact that there are kind of less glitches in these adventures than some stuff that was pumped out later just to get to something to market. The motif is basically, and I say this as a compliment, basically lifted from DeCamp and Pratt novel in the Enchantress Stories, their first novel called The Roaring Trumpet. And so that has your lead wizards get dropped into a Nordic world where Thor and Loki are going into a big hall with a bunch of giants and having to contend with them and try to find the magic trumpet. And then there's a secondary place run by fire giants that have a bunch of troll servants. And the whole dressing and setting and what's going on and what is the hall like and what are the kitchens like and who are your servants is basically taken from a great piece of literature. And I think that that's awesome, frankly. Anybody that's going to run these series, I highly recommend you've got to read The Roaring Trumpet, which is totally the inspiration for this stuff. And I like D&D being about something else. I like D&D not just being about itself eating its own table, but commentary on literature and mythology. And that's totally what's happening here. So I think that that's one of the strongest series. It's great that there's intelligent opponents throughout that you can negotiate and talk with possibly. It's great. Yep. There's this secret mastermind, right? And now obviously it brings in secretly, slowly, the drow underground elves, which is, you know, was very exciting at the time and kind of took over a lot of thought. So there's a lot of great stuff here. And I will also point out that the big boss in the first adventure that's in that cover right there is Shade being thrown at Dave Arneson. So that's supposed to be Dave Arneson at a point where Gygax and he were very, very, very angry at each other. And he has a whole bunch of like really foul things that he says about that boss there. That's a really representation of Arneson there. So a lot of passion being put into this, a lot of great motivation, inspiration, and I would run this over and over and over again.
And I've played these, obviously, as you ran them at HelgaCon. And I think, you know, that was probably around the time when I was really starting to look at the old modules again and collect them and read them. But I knew you were running them, so I specifically held off reading them. And I will admit that by at this point today in 2026, I still have not read any of them.
Okay.
And I think, just because. Yeah, and I could.
And I probably Maybe I'll run them a third time.
Hey, man, I don't know. Yeah, but it's funny, right? I specifically avoid, and I think I remember at the time, like, having this mental note of, like, okay, cool, after Dan is done running them, but after you were done running them, it's like a three-year sequence, because you were running them once a year at HelgaCon. Yeah. So, you know, I was like, okay, eventually I'll come back and read them when Dan's done running them. I just never got to it. Funny.
That's funny.
Am I missing something? I suppose that's my question to you. Am I missing something great by not reading them, or is the greatness in the presentation of play? Right? Have I experienced all the best stuff, or will I gain something by also reading them?
I would recommend that you. I'm sure there's stuff that's in there that you never saw. They are big for single sessions, and I do think that they were, my understanding is that there are two or three levels each, that was basically what was put on the table in the tournaments. You know, we know that later tournaments were very railroady, they're going to have nine rooms and you go walk through rooms 1 through 9. These weren't that. I think they were designed as complexes at the outset, which is not really the best thing for a tournament, frankly. So they're kind of big for a tournament. They're big for a single session. That's actually a little bit awkward. So there's definitely a bunch of stuff there that we didn't get to in our play sessions. You know, I think it's the interesting thing about our hobby that we kind of have if someone gives us an adventure module, that's basically a script. But we have no idea what the plot is until we actually play through it. Plot in scare quotes. But I, you know, they're short, they're brief. I think it's interesting to look at. I would recommend that you look at maybe at least the first one. And if you say this hurts your eyeballs, then stop at that point. It's only 8 pages long. No.
Yeah. I'm not worried that they're terrible. I'm just kind of curious if how much it'll add to my own experience of those modules. Again, having gotten to play them, and you're right that like a lot of times I will read modules, because I'm imagining running them. Right, I'm thinking about how will I run this, and these modules generally are at a level that I typically don't run. This is a bit too high level for my tastes. So an interesting comparison point that we maybe should talk about here is the A series, which both you and I have run, and we've talked about maybe we'll do a deeper dive on that series in the future. But they show up very heavily in my own convention spreadsheet, because there was a period of time where I was very curious about the tournament scene, and I wanted to see if I could recreate some of that for myself, at least by running them tournament style at some conventions. And very specifically, I took A1 and ran multiple sessions of that at a convention once, and a couple conventions actually, as I remember. If you look up on my blog, you will find somewhere a report of I kept scores, right? I actually recorded all the scores of the different groups I ran it for, so I could come back and look and kind of see, you know, in this asynchronous way, how did they stack up against each other? So, like, A1 is probably on my list of all of them. I like A1 a lot. A4 is also very clever because of the whole conceit of take away all the players' stuff and see how they do. Yeah. And the middle, less good. Let me just say that. Less good in the middle. But I also really liked the conceit of the first round of what is essentially the first round of the tournament is four separate dungeons, right? They had four variants of the that were all run concurrently. And then the top scores of that moved on to the second round, which would have been A3, right? Because I think you get two of the first rounders in A1 and two of the first rounders in A2. And there's something that I find delightful about that kind of mirroring the real world of what was going on when they're running these modules, right? Because the conceit is there's all these slavers, and so we're sending multiple teams to go infiltrate them and gather information and whatnot. So concurrently, different teams are going to do different things. And literally, that's what's happening, right? At the convention, we're running four different variants of this adventure, And so people presumably at the convention could have compared notes. Oh, what did your team do? Wow, that's totally different from what my team got, right? I think that's very interesting and fun. You point out some of the pitfalls. Again, this isn't super high on my list because it's, especially if you run it in the tournament style, it's very linear, right?
Yeah.
It's mostly set piece followed by set piece followed by set. Great set pieces, but it is just a they sequence are. Of set pieces.
Mostly.
I
feel that I agree. The attraction of the A series is that they very clearly delineate how the tournament was run. It specifically shows here's the rooms we use for the tournament, and then here's the stuff that we added for a campaign that isn't. They have a very clear, mostly very clear right. scoring system. So it's attractive for both of us, I think, to let's experiment with what it feels like to run one of these tournaments. They're not on, you know, like you, it's in overall the A series is actually not on my favorite adventures. All the dungeons are wonky or nonsensical in some ways. Even the first one, there's significant problems just with the geometry of it, frankly. and I have to do some legwork of trying to excuse why this crazy layout exists the way it does. It's an interesting experiment to run. We should probably talk more about our experiences because we have in a future episode because we've both done that.
And I will say for myself, it is in the sweet spot of the level range I enjoy playing, which is nice.
Yeah, good point. Yes, agreed. Yep, good point on that. Should we talk about B2? Should we cut? So I do have like Keep on the Borderland on my list. Is that a commonality for both of us, Paul?
Nope, it's not on my list.
Really? Oh my God.
Yep. I always kind of assumed that a lot of the draw of B2, now B2 I have read, a lot of the draw of B2 in my mind was about the nostalgia factor. And I don't have that nostalgia factor. I never ran it back in the day. I never played it back in the day. And when I read it in more recently, I was like, it's okay. It's okay. It's just a bunch of caves with a bunch of monsters. I don't know.
It's not bulletproof. Yep, it's not bulletproof. It is you can that then that right there is a legitimate among the top criteria and top criticisms. I like the fact there's a bunch of different ways to get in. There's a bunch of different approaches and orders. It's like the opposite of linear. It's a little repetitive, I like the fact that there's this, you know, that there's a wilderness. You get a community component. You get a wilderness search for it component. You get the dungeon component. Paul's suffering from allergies, and we apologize. Paul is really being a mensch today, queuing up for the show, because a lesser man would have thrown the towel. And Paul is here to give you viewers a good Wandering DMs episode on a day when he probably should have thrown the towel.
Appreciate that. I warned Dan at the beginning that I might be riding the mute button here when I have to have a few sneezes. So apologies, everybody. You know, it's a little Murder at the Zoo, though, right? It's like, okay, some of the encounters are a little nicer, right? In that they've got a bit going on, right? You've got the things like the kobolds with their passphrase and such, but it's still just, to me, it just feels like a lot of combat encounters. And then you do have the keep itself, which seems very interesting, but there's just not that much guidance about what to do with that. And
totally agree.
So, not on my list.
And I think I had the first, I might have said this before, the first time I had a player alone with two characters adventure there, they did not understand that. They did very little guy. I mean, we're, I don't know, 12, 13, 14. And they went into the keep and thought that was the murder zoo and started just murdering people in the keep to take their stuff, and was taken, thrown in the prison. And again, canonically, I think that those characters have still been in prison in the keep for low these 40 years. Absolutely. And the other thing I would say that if I do, even if I think about running it, you have the problem of how do you handle the non-combatants that are in the caves. And, you know, Gygax was in a naturalistic, there's a community here. There has to be, you know, background support and common family areas. And how what are the player characters supposed to do with those is a pretty awkward thing to deal with that I'd prefer not to poke these days.
I do have, Dan, a B-series module on my list. Any guess on which one it is?
Interesting. Okay, now, I mean, I was going to ask a question, like, if you had to run B1 or B2, which one would you prefer? Now, I know a lot of people like B5, which always surprises me. So my top guesses would be either B1 or B5.
It is, and this might be a bit of a trick question, it is B Solo.
Oh, no, that's good. I like that. No, but okay, yeah. Fair, good.
The Ghost good of Lion Castle, which we played here on the channel some point.
We did.
The solo modules have a special place in my heart. I think that one in particular is very good.
Yes.
Interesting. And I would play that one again. And the funny thing is, I can anytime I want because it's a solo adventure.
That great memory. Viewers, you can see back in the COVID lockdown, Paul and I played that together over a couple evenings, so you can see our playlist where we're doing that kind of thing.
It was an interesting discovery over lockdown that actually the solo adventures are perhaps more fun when played with a friend, which seems contradictory to the whole solo experience. And yet, there you go, having another person to joke around with as you go through it is actually quite fun.
Great point. And that brings up, okay, so that brings up another one of my favorites that some people don't know about, and that is the Gem and the Staff, which was published as module 01 for basic D&D. I don't know if we want to pull up the cover to that. It's got this orange, it's kind of bright orange cover to it.
I'll give you a bit of-
Get zoom tight. And so this is another case where this what went through playtesting. So this was run at conventions. It's not the main names you might think about in D&D publishing by John and Laurie Vandegraaff. And so this is an adventure that they wrote. They had in conventions. They played for a number of times. And again, a tournament, technically a tournament module. It's got scoring in it. It is for just one player, right? It's presumably a DM. And one player, Paul and I also ran this in our live stream two-person gaming series. And so it's made for just one thief. And I love that idea. And I frankly wish that I personally had the creativity to make more solo thief adventures. And I've never been able to make that work. But you have a solo thief who needs to intrude on a wizard's tower and then a wizard's cave system. And there's a bunch of there's some combat, there's some magical puzzly tricks, there's some illusions and puzzles and stuff like that. It's pretty tight. It has a good scoring system. It comes with complete battle maps and even cutout figures for all the pieces that are going to be in the game. So it's kind of set up for miniature play. I've run this many times. The sessions are only supposed to be 1 hour. So I think that at tournaments, you'd have like four players queued up and you'd run four different people through it in a 4 hour session. So very different structure. And I've had at least, I've run this for probably all my friends at some point. Cause again, it just takes an hour. It's almost, it's for an eighth level thief, but it can be kind of a pretty good introduction to D&D, frankly. And I've had at least one player that I was trying to introduce to D&D. They'd probably played it three or four times and they ran this. And they went, well, this is what D&D should be like. Puzzles and tricks and brain teasers and all this kind of stuff. This is what D&D should be like, they said. So I kind of adore this. And I have run it many, many times, frankly. And it's always really interesting to run it for a new player.
Fascinating. I was trying to remember. I'm looking it up now. There you go. So we ran it also, as you mentioned, on the channel. And it looks like we took over an hour and a half, hour 45, to play this. Interesting.
We did.
Interesting.
And I think we did two sessions.
Usually fit in an hour to you?
You know, I struggle with the timing on all this older stuff. Frankly, the timing on all these classic tournament adventures saying it should take this. I mean, I inevitably struggle with the timing on those things. So I probably not. Like every tournament adventure, it always goes long for me.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, not that you're under any. I mean, I guess if you're right about what you're surmising there, that they were running it for four people over a single 4-hour convention slot and doing them in sequence. That sounds intense, right? Not only is that like hard to fit all that content in 1 hour, but then like, you know, you gotta next, just cycle people through and run it again and again. And yeah, Dan loves this. This is.
Yeah, I do. Yes, please. That sounds great. That is exactly what I want to do. You know, one thing I've learned recently is that, you know, they tended to have, I've caught this in some other tournament adventures where you have like at the tournament and then here's the publication, is that, you know, they'd have the tournament thing, it would be very curt. And it would say, this is supposed to run in 3 hours. And then for publication, oh, let's add some stuff. Let's add another area. Let's add another encounter. Let's expand this encounter. And they don't update the time number. And so I think that might be part of what I keep running into, is that they've got an expanded version, but they didn't update the time number. I don't know if that's part of what's happened here or not, but I think that's part of my problem sometimes.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that gets lost, that they don't, right? It was nice that they published the A series and like specifically highlighted these are the rooms that it were included and this is the path for the tournament. And why didn't they include that in other adventures? I don't know. Strange.
Yeah.
Great. And the other TSR series module on my list is L1, Secret of Bone Hill. That's probably a surprise to no one. That I adore that module, and more though, I guess I adore that more as not like it's not an adventure I'm going to sit down and run like as a convention game. I would never do that. I use it as a starting sandbox for a new campaign, right? It's a great like starting point of here is what I would hope that B2 would be and isn't, right? It's this lovely sandbox of here are NPCs who could matter. Here are some small adventures scattered about the wilderness for you to go on. One in town in a you know cave system under a shop. But it's a microcosm of how I like to run my campaigns in general, which is to give the players a nice home base, a big open sandbox, and then to scatter smaller adventures throughout rather than have one. Like, I'm not a mega dungeon guy. I want lots of little adventures for the players to go out and explore and discover. And that's basically exactly what it is. And so that is my go-to, that adventure. The organization of the module itself is not the best, and I have extensively gone through it to like reformat it. At one point, I rewrote the whole thing, transcribed the whole thing into a wiki, so I could just have that on a computer and jump from spot to spot to spot, which kind of, you know, that hyperlinking helps a lot. Unfortunately, I would say like on the downside, it's not obvious how to go, right? It doesn't give you a lot of guidance as DM, which is what I like about it. But it doesn't give you a lot of guidance as like, here's the, how a player might go through it.
Right.
It's just, here's a bunch of stuff. Good luck.
One thing I always think about, and I love your experience with Bone Hill and that works over and over again for you, is that it's a little, you know, it's unique in a couple ways. And it's, you know, that's written by LaKafka along with his Lendor Isles L modules. I mean, among the many unique things, it's got a deal where you get monster rosters. And like, if you run into stuff and wandering monsters, you're supposed to like cross them off in the overall monster population. Do you find that that's a good thing or too complicated? Just as one little detail there.
I've never done it.
Okay. Well, there you go. There's my answer. Good call.
I don't know if it like consciously, I thought it was a bad idea. Maybe it was just too fiddly, right? I'm like, I'm not going to deal with that. Whatever.
Okay.
you know, there might be cases where easier to remember stuff, you know, if the players have a big encounter with, say, the gnolls on this hill, and they, you know, do a big thing that should disrupt them and make them flee, then maybe I'll stop rolling for gnolls over there. But I've never, like, one for one counted how many gnolls are left. What are they doing? Never bothered with that.
Got it. Interesting. I always think about in that, you know, one thing is in that adventure that I always really like is that there is a temple to the god of luck in the wilderness, and it's just a casino. So when you pay homage to the god of luck, you just, it's like pick what table game you want, and the tribute to the priest is the table stakes, is the house cut, and I'm like, I kind of adore that.
You know, inevitably, what I end up doing, of course, is hiding more adventures in here, and yeah, like starting with that map, and oh, there's clearly this lovely cave opening over here in this mountain. I'm going to put a different dungeon there, and I just start monkeying with it. So it is almost more toolkit than adventure for me.
I see that.
And so my experience of running it may not be exactly what you expect, because I don't think I've ever run it precisely by the book. In some cases, I have just totally relocated a hole, right? I've taken the actual Bone Hill itself. I've taken the titular dungeon and ripped it out and replaced it completely with a different dungeon.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, but I love the evil sorcerer and his bugbear guards, and they're in this castle with this kind of weird war going on with the undead that emerge at night. And so depending on what time of day you show up, you might get a totally different experience. I really like that. It's super fun. I've had some great moments in there where I had a whole party get almost completely TPK'd by that wizard. And then just to have the one person who is still standing at the end of the fight decide to surrender and pledge his allegiance to that evil wizard. And I guess evil's stretching it, right? I don't know. Is he evil? He's hanging out with his bugbears. Like, you're invading his castle. I don't know. Is he evil?
Yes.
What is he doing that's so evil?
Just look at him.
Just look at him.
Because F that guy. That's why.
Yeah. Well,
now I'm thinking about that's what you did when we played Dyson's Delve, right?
It is, and that's a nice segue, Dan, because Dyson's Delve easily at the top of my list of adventures I will run again and again. It is such a good adventure, so nice. I will 100% run that any time of day, and yeah, I absolutely dropped Dyson's Delve. Right, it's real nice into those hills. And then it gives you another little bit of history that you can tie into the town, and great.
Yeah, we had a wonderful time playing that. Frankly, that was really great. And viewers, you can watch us do that in one of our other streams online.
Unfortunately, only the second half. Right. We did that across two different birthdays of mine. We did the first half and then later the second half, and so you only get to see the second half.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Crazy. Right. Am I wrong about that? Didn't we?
I don't think so. I thought that was one session, although I think the very first session might have gotten glitched up technically as we learned how to do that. So we might be missing one or two sessions, but I thought it was all the same weekend, I thought.
Interesting. Interesting. Am I wrong about I swear I have this recollection of splitting it across two different weekends.
Only
recording half of it. Maybe it's the other way around. Maybe we only recorded the first half. I can't remember.
Okay, viewers, if you have better recollection.
I mean, this is ancient of what we did online DM's lore for here. Yeah, which would
I was
been
focused on playing. I was focused
ago,
on
right?
beating the thing. Right, I wasn't focused on what was being broadcast. I was focused. I've got to lead this team and beat this adventure. Right, it was horrible under the rats and the dragon and all this crap, and that's what I was focused on. So I don't remember when or where we did that exactly.
That is funny. I'm gonna see if I can quickly jog my memory here if YouTube will help me. Well, why don't you hit us, Dan, with what's next on your list?
I was going to mention Caverns of Thracia by Janelle Jaques, and that was another game that we ran as a weekend at one of Paul's birthdays, and we did not stream that or record that. I kind of wish we did. We had a great time with that, and you know, I pulled it out. I wasn't familiar with their work very much, but it, at the table, it kind of had this magic experience of a whole bunch of stuff that I didn't expect to have happen that really worked for all the players that we had. My partner Isabel was there, and she was really excited by it. Great design. Jaques, you know, really set a new standard in adventure design for D&D at the outset. You know, her work kind of was almost one of the things that really forced TSR into the business of publishing modules, because clearly they were so successful and so exciting. A great layout. Again, a lot of different interconnections between levels and areas and places that the players can take a whole bunch of different approaches to exploring it. You can't predict it as the DM. Every location is a really clever, creative series of designs. And, you know, at the outset, clearly even Gygax was, you know, here's a bunch of rooms and a bunch of monsters and a bunch of treasures. That's enough at least to get started with. And Jaques came in and was doing something very different. There was something very motivating and interesting and well described in every location. And I fondly recall there's one single area that is listed as empty. And even for that, she has like a 3-paragraph conversation about what it means to be an empty room. It's like, well, I'm supposed to have an empty room, so here it is, but I'm not really comfortable with that. So there's going to be this painting on the wall that gives you a clue about someplace else. There's no monster or treasure, but you know, here's what I think about empty rooms. And so even the one single empty room is like a really interesting back and forth between the reader and Jaques. Again, lots of intelligent opponents. So as you go in, there's possibly factions. You can consider, should we negotiate? Should we fight? Should we trick them? Should we hide? And that gives a lot of layers and a lot of texture to how you approach it. Again, with these kind of communities of a bunch of intelligent monsters that know each other through the different levels. So that was a real banger.
Is that a recurring theme, do you think, there? Is that part of... Because I can't help but note that that's also one of the things I adore about Dyson's Delve, is I spent a lot of time analyzing the different factions, many of whom can be negotiated with, and that is part of the joy of that particular adventure for me, is that it seems to be a commonality amongst a lot of the stuff that we're talking about here.
I think that's a thing that dawned on me while I was making my list for this episode, actually, is it's good to have really not just one-off intelligent monsters, but kind of communities of intelligent monsters to give an opportunity to maybe interact with them in this different way. It is. What else were you, Paul, that would surprise me?
Other things on my list. I mean, the other classic module that's on my list that is not TSR but is classic is Hangman's Hill, which I ran.
Oh, yeah.
I think I ran that at HelgaCon. Possibly, were you in that game? I don't recall. But that that one is particularly fun. That's one of those ones where I learned the trick of, this is a case of where I played it at a convention. Loved it so much, I'm like, I gotta run this myself, and so ran it myself, and then of course stole some of the ideas of what I saw the DM who was running it for me do. And the main thing here was drawing on a piece of graph paper the outline of the mansion. Right, the conceit is this is haunted mansion that is utterly gone. All that remains is the foundation, but if you go on a certain night, it reappears, and you have this limited chunk of time in which to go explore it. This is a Judges Guild adventure from I don't know when early. Very early 80s, maybe late 70s, I can't remember. And so I like that conceit. Again, this is a case of like, you know, I like blurring the line, I guess, between like real world and the fantasy world. I like this notion that, oh, we can go during the day and at least study the foundation and get an idea of the space. And then I will hand them, well, here's a piece of graph paper with the foundation drawn on it. Right? And now that's your map, and you can go fill that in when the place actually shows up and you start walking through it.
I agree. That's nice.
What I had to 100% had to clean up that map to do that, because it's in that era of like, what happened? The graph lines don't really line up quite so well with the rooms. There's like a bunch of old modules,
you're right, especially
Judges Guild stuff, right, I think, from that era that's like that, where it's like, what happened?
Yeah.
Did they it seems like maybe they drew it on graph paper and then removed the graph paper and then re-imposed a graph on top of it, and it's just not quite right or something. I don't know.
That's a good question. Yeah.
Yeah. Good point. I had to clean that map up, but that is fun. And it's just, this is very classic D&D adventure haunted house kind of place. And there's a lot of weird stuff going on, which is delightful. A lot of tricks and oddities. And then, and of course, a villain who will talk to you that you can communicate with and maybe try to, you know, broker a deal, or more likely just attack.
Nice.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I want to look at some of the what our viewers are suggesting in the chat, and maybe pick out particularly ones that like I also like and have overlooked here in the conversation. So, Village of Hamlet, T1, right? Again, Gygax's same year as B2, I think. Kind of same kind of instinct of like, let's provide an introductory module. Solid. I would run that. There's something a little thin about it where I don't think I want to run it 100 times like I would some other stuff. Okay, now module B4. That's a good thing I might overlook. So Celestian GC suggested module G4, which is the Lost City. And there's a lot to love about that. So Lost Pyramid and Desert, players get stuck into that. It starts at level 1, 1, 2, 3. The levels get bigger as you go down the pyramid and higher levels. And then there's at least a sketch about a whole horrible cosmic underground area and a giant cavern with crazy lost society, psychos, and all this kind of stuff. The overall, I think it's by Tom Moldvay, if I recall correctly. So it's one of those things. And I could pick out other things like the Desert Nomad series for me, X4, X5, X10, or even the Against the Drow series, D1 through 3, where the motif and the setting are incredibly compelling. And then when I get into the actual details, the nuts and bolts of the adventure, I start having trouble with it. The geometry of the pyramid in B4 in the first couple levels, how people get around, I'm suddenly confused by. So I get a little bit frustrated when I start to get in the nuts and bolts of the B4 pyramid. But the overall ideas are very, very compelling, and you pick it up, and the art's great, and it makes me want to love it. And then I personally would run other stuff myself.
Dan, we're getting close to time here, so I'm going to just kind of quickly try to blow through what's left on my list, and you can, if there's anything of interest, we can call that out
and talk
about it a little bit more. I have been running Aberrant Reflections by Direct Sun, who's on the show recently. I've run that like several times now, and I think I'm just finally starting to figure it out, and I could run it effectively if I did it again. I do think I can run it as a convention game, which is surprising. I wouldn't mind running it in a slightly longer setting.
Yeah.
So that's a great one. I have two 1-page dungeon contest entries that I will regularly pull out that are really good. The Citadel of the Severed Hand and the Vault of Zerduzan, just both really nice, good, solid dungeons that are, you know, that I've plunked out and run as convention games or thrown into campaigns. They're easy to slide in there. They're really great. I will call out one kind of genre bending adventure a little bit, which is Something Stinks in Stilton, which I think was written for Lamentations of the Flame Princess. I have run it in D&D. I have run it in Fearful Ends. This could be a horror game. It could be an adventure game. It's definitely, you know, you have to be okay with it having some pretty gross horror elements in it. That's a super fun one. And then the last thing I want to call out, which is unusual, right, is my own stuff. Frankly, a lot of the time, things that I will run over and over again is my own invention, stuff that I created for a campaign, especially in cases where I've created for a campaign and then plucked it out and reused it elsewhere. I have a group of adventures that I now refer to in my own notes as the Amoria sequence, which is a group of adventures that I've now run at HelgaCon as nice little snippets of my home campaign. So that includes the adventures Gloomwood Falls, the Lost Tablets of Amoria, and the Isle of Turris. And so those are... some folks may remember... Oh, I should have had it in front with me here. Some folks may remember that the Isle of Turris was kind of the culmination of these adventures that involves exploring a large hex outdoor space that is an island. And I had built a big magnetic map of it with little hexagon magnets covering every hexagon, so as you explored it you could peel off the hexes. I think that used to be, yeah, that surely featured in some episode, past episode, and I remember there was some footage of it in our opening sequence for a little while.
Right. Yeah, I played that was great. We could possibly have a whole episode on, like, you know, hex crawl exploring. Have we done that? Now I can't remember if we've done that, but I'm
pretty sure we have, but yeah, we could do it again.
You know, someone mentioned Isle of Dread in the chat here, which is kind of in the similar zone there, which is tighter than some other like ex-wilderness type modules, certainly. You know, for me, Isle of the Ape is kind of in that direction, at least. So, but I love the fact that some of it's your own creation. And I love the fact that it was, again, playtested in a campaign, right? So the stuff that stands the test of time is stuff that was run and you know, isn't just in theory, but actually works at the table, and we can recognize that and use it and want to use it again later.
Yeah, yeah. Of those, right, there's just a couple that just map really well to a convention game. The Gloomwood Falls game, it's a fairly big dungeon, but the whole goal is to find the way. It's supposed to be in the side of a big cliff face, and the whole point is to get to the top. So you're looking for, you've kind of come into the dungeon from the side rather than going down, and you're trying to look for a way up, and there's at least three exits up. And so it's a big space with a lot of different stuff you can explore, but and three exits, which is really fun.
Right.
It's fun to rerun multiple times to see how different groups run at it. Right?
Yep. So those are
Lost
interesting.
The Lost Tablets of Amoria is my take on Quagmire, right? It's my take on at least the conceit from Quagmire of, let me take one dungeon and restock it three times and put it in different environments. I love that conceit. I don't think that Quagmire did it that great. I was happy to steal that and make what I feel was a better version of it.
Nice. So a couple of common themes, right, are having like intelligent communities of monsters, possibly with factions, having multiple entry exits, right? Having multiple different ways for the players to get in and out. Having not be linear are interesting things to make it rerunnable. I'm also really intrigued by what you said about Aberrant Reflections, as you've run it maybe whatever you said there 5-6 times, and you feel like you're just getting the point where you can run it well. And this is not something many people talk about with D&D, you know, hobby gaming. Of do you need to do it a number of times before you're good at it? As a DM, I also kind of have a similar feeling. Like I'm intrigued by Tomb of Horrors. Frankly, I like the idea of Tomb of Horrors. There's a lot of problems with it being super high level. Again, it being really designed to break the expectations of expert players, right? And finding that group that also doesn't know the adventure is kind of hard. But I kind of want to run Tomb of Horrors again because I think I could do a better job with it, frankly. And I feel that way about a couple of adventures like that.
The really fascinating thing about Aberrant Reflections, and the reason I call it out, is because it did require practice, because in the earlier games, as I run through it, and I think of the times I've run it, I've made glaring errors, right? I've made errors in interpreting it. because I misread the map or didn't realize quite what the text was getting at or something like that. It does involve this weird two existence, right? The you know, slight spoiler here, right? There's sort of the real world and the parallel dimension world that you have to think about at the same time. So the fun thing is, it's got all these puzzles for the players that encourages them to, you know, use lateral thinking to solve. But on the other hand, you as DM constantly have to challenge yourself with this problem of, well, let me, how do I interpret what happens here, knowing what I know that they don't know about duality of the space, which right. is sometimes very difficult. And there's definitely been moments when I've been running that game where somebody says something that seems fairly straightforward. Oh, I do blah, blah, blah. And I go, hang on, I got to think this one through. What happens? What gear are you carrying? Where are you? What? Okay, and what path are you taking? Okay, and then I got to walk through it mentally, and it's super. So it's actually really, it's very difficult to run. It's more challenging to run than most stuff I've run. Have you read
it? You're trying to sell this to me, is what I'm hearing. You're trying to say Dan would enjoy running this. I totally have. We got copies from Direct Sun. They're actually kind of gorgeous books. I love the graphic design, the way they use color to try to, in both the maps and the art, to try to communicate the two different planes of existence. It's a really, really clever. I haven't run it, but I have read it, and I adore the book.
Yeah, it's clever. My one critique is I wish he had used more words to describe some of the spaces. Because, like I said, there's some cases where I missed some detail because, oh, I didn't look closely enough at the map and realized that that's colored in this color and not that color, and therefore it exists here and not there, and here's why, right? And there's a lot of that, like, why? Why is it important that it exists here and not there? Like, I think there could have been some more text there about, like, you know, note, if the players have this object when they're in this room, they could run into these kinds of problems.
It's such an interesting dilemma about, like, more, you know, too much text, and we've also now have cases of, like, maybe too little text, and, you know, stuff like late era Gygax at TSR, like Temple of Elemental Evil, is like way too long. It's like pages and pages and pages for one encounter area, and then you have a case like this that's maybe too short, and, you know, that's one of the things I love. The Giant series is about kind of what's good for me of, like, you know, it's a paragraph. It's, you're not limited to, you know, any particular format. You can write a short paragraph or two paragraphs. And for me, that's kind of about the extent that I like for text, but it's really interesting. And it probably varies by reader, and it varies by have you run this more than once. And what an interesting dilemma it is to get to dial in the right amount of text to make it parsable.
Yeah. Dan, we are definitely out of time now. Do you have any final thoughts on favorite adventures?
Well, it's interesting about, like, how much of it's colored by nostalgia. I tend to think not very much for me, because some of the classic stuff I've run into very late in life and decided that I love this stuff that I didn't have available when I was a kid. I love the G series. I think that's maybe Gygax's finest moment, right out of the box as far as published adventures go. And having things with, like, like intelligent communities of monsters, like we said, a bunch of different ways in and out to provide flexibility. And if players get stuck one way, they can take another approach. And then the solo, surprisingly, the solo modules, which there aren't many of, but are, like, these really unique little, literally gems, after having pointed out Gem in the staff, are also interesting. And then, you know, big thanks to Jay Quays, who really kind of revolutionized these intelligent monsters in large spaces with a lot of interconnections and really kind of advanced the state of the art. So there's a lot of great stuff out there.
Yeah, totally agree. Viewers, if you have opinions on your favorite module that we did not cover, or an adventure that you would love to hear our thoughts on, please leave us a comment here in the YouTube video. We would love to hear from you. Maybe that will spin off a new conversation for the future.
Definitely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube and Twitch, Facebook, TikTok Loops, and GitHub. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all the sites, so please look for us there and cleave onto that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those files are on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find us on various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those sites and it gives the ability to do so, please consider giving us a 5-star review. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do, and we really also appreciate our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Like Paul said at the top of the hour, every tier gets you access to our private Discord server. We just have wonderful conversations with our patrons and all kinds of creative ideas about old school D&D and new and adventures and westerns and horror games and miniatures and war games and everything that we adore. So we would love for you to join us there and be part of that conversation. And we will be there in about 10 minutes to continue this conversation with our live video after chat. I had, you know, I actually had other adventures I didn't get to in the hour here, I might mention there, or other stuff that we didn't get to in the chat. So we would love to hear you have more of a conversation in our live video after chat in about 10 minutes. What a great idea for a discussion this was today from one of the prior after chats, and maybe we'll have more ideas spinning out of that. Don't forget, of course, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, so we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.